You had a what? You did? Oh, you got to work? I'm still worried about mine, like, because it's cracked in two spots. Well,
I know it's crazy.
I'm doing both.
Are you any better?
Kind of. It was worse yesterday, but today I'm better. I don't know. It's weird. Okay, everybody. So today we're going to be talking about madness in the 18th century, or we should say madness in the long 18th century, much more the 17th into the 18th century. To that end, what we're going to be talking about are the accounts of madness in large part, in a sense about what first-hand testimonials sound like to persons who are incarcerated or institutionalized. Not because they're consistent. Hopefully the selection I gave you gave you a sense that there's a very wide disparity in terms of motivations and perspectives of the complaint and experiences to have been institutionalized, but to get more of a flavor of what the stakes are and what the dilemmas are, both psychologically and also strategically in terms of thinking about the madhouse as a specific new kind of institution in the 17th and 18th century. Before we take a look at those accounts, though, what I want to have us do is read a selection from Foucault's Madness and Civilization, in particular his chapter on the Great Confinement. I gave you a supplementary article to go with it from the Times, from London, called Scholarship of Fools, which is a play on Foucault's interest in the ship of fools. So yeah. This is a kind of scathing sort of like critique, if you will, coinciding with a expanded translation of the complete version of Foucault's History of Madness, which we'll talk more about. The other thing we're talking about today are some prints or some engravings based on paintings by William Hogarth. What I thought I would do, actually, before we start talking about madness, sort of get our juices flowing, I apologize for blowing my nose. I've been sick the past few days, so that means, though, that when we start reading things out loud, volunteers will be much appreciated since I'm a little hoarse. I want to start by having us look at a different set of engravings by William Hogarth, ones that don't particularly deal with madness, but hopefully will provide for us a little bit of an entree to the Hogarth paintings we're going to look at later from Rake's Progress, but also to get a sense of kind of the satirical stakes when we're talking about this kind of institutionalization, if you will. Now, this is from a famous series. Now, how many of you are familiar with William Hogarth, who he is? You probably aren't, unless you study 18th century English literature or culture. He's a famous portrait artist and series portrait artist. Almost all of his portraits he did in series, not unlike Four Stages of Cruelty, which I just passed out to you. And if you're not here today, it'll be online in a second. And Rake's Progress, which we had to look at for today. Hogarth's dates are 1697 to 1764, which are less important in their specificity than rather that we get a general sense that we're looking at a guy who was producing satirical works at a time when satire was at its height, not just in English culture, but European culture in general, and where the culprits, the butts of the critique, were quite often institutions, political institutions, royal institutions, and as we'll see, sometimes medical institutions at that. Now, Hogarth is a painter and a satirist. He's famous for several series, A Rake's Progress, which I had you look at before today, The Four Stages of Cruelty, which I just gave you. He did another one called Marriage a la Mode, which critiques marriage propriety standards in the 18th century England. He also did a series called Gin Lane and Beer Lane. This might be the one that people are most familiar with. They're portraits of, like, basically a bunch of drunk people on the streets in England. It's the whole satirizing the problem of a little too much drink in English culture, so to speak. Now, what I want to start with is having us look at the Four Stages of Cruelty, which I just gave to you in four plates. I've provided little captions for you to use as to what the four stages are, and I want us to look specifically at, like I said, a little bit of sort of the things that are satirized and the things that are dramatized in these portraits. For while this is outside of the madhouse and independent of it, we'll find that a lot of the culprits and a lot of the variables that are at play here are similar. So starting at the top left, we have the first stage of cruelty, which I've described as cruelty in childhood to animals. So does anybody notice anything in particular in the first plate in the upper left that speaks to cruelty? I know they're a little small, but do your best.
Somebody's cutting the tail off the dog.
Yeah, and so in the middle we can see, or to be frank with you, I think they're actually shoving something up its rectum.
Oh.
Yeah, just a little better. I'll see you one tail, and I'll raise you one.
Isn't a dog eating a dog? A cat.
Yeah, it looks like an animal is eating another disemboweled animal, which is probably not a tribute to the cruelty of that dog, but rather that somebody has disemboweled that animal, and then a dog has come to clean it up. What else?
A
see what's going under the lamppost. I mean, I can't figure that out.
Looks like they're having something.
Chicken? The back one, it looks like cats. It looks like they're hanging cats by their tails on the back post.
Thrown out a window?
Yeah, it looks like somebody hurled an animal out the window, doesn't it? Or some kind of clawed thing or something.
Are they preparing to shoot the chicken with something?
Where's the chicken?
The chicken.
Oh, right. And then you know, I wonder if it's a cockfight. You know? I feel like the cockfight might be the sign of cruelty there.
The dog in the foreground?
I guess that's taunting. What do you think? It's definitely...
This is
the there's definitely something of nefarious intended.
It's like there's something being thrown from the window as well.
Yeah, totally. We said we can't figure out what it is, but something has been hurled, for sure. Let's look at the second plate on the right. We have the second stage of cruelty, which this one features a lot of cruelty towards animals as well. The major thing to notice, of course, is these are adults now. Yeah.
This might sound like a really stupid question.
Yeah.
What exactly is a plate? Is that just like a frame, or is it specific type of art or something?
A plate is usually referred to the thing that makes an imprint for an engraving, or sometimes is referred to the print itself as a result of it. So, for example, all of these are famous portraits, paintings that Hogarth did. So oils on large canvases. Now, so popular were they, not just in terms of people who wanted to go see them in galleries, but also in the discourse, that like a lot of famous artwork at the time was made into plates and engravings. Now, there probably would have been a different engraver who translated this from the portrait, although interestingly, Hogarth was actually trained as an engraver during his first apprenticeship before he became a painter. So he would have been very savvy and mindful of when doing paintings. How could this make a good engraving, so to speak? So in this case, these are the prints. Not unlike when we saw the frontispieces in the front pages of novels, these also would have hung in the windows of bookshops as something that one would have had as a collectible or wanted to sort of purchase. So looking at the top right then, this one, the second stage of cruelty. What are a few standout
cruelties? Whipping the horse.
Yeah, whipping the horse. Bludgeoning a sheep in the bottom right.
What did you say?
A person like stuck under...
Yeah, that's another example. So that if it's a cruelty, not just for the animal, there's like a boy who has been basically run over by a beer cart, I guess. Again, these are small, so they're hard to make out, but we can assume there's various and sundry mean things in the back happening. Looks like there's a bull, doesn't it, in the back?
It looks like it's a very overloaded animal.
Yeah, there's that one in the middle, absolutely, looks like it's absolutely overloaded. The main thing to note in Hogarth's paintings is that there's quite often a protagonist from image to image in these series. So in this case, the man that's beating the horse here in the second image, I forget what his name is. They actually have names, these characters, that are mentioned somewhere in the small print, but it's the guy with the hat beating with the stick, so to speak. He's one of the kids in the first picture. I think he's the one holding the dog about to be anally penetrated, so to speak. So now he's in the second one, and professionally he's become a coach driver and is cruel to his own animals that he uses for a living. If we look at the third portrait, the third engraving, the bottom left, cruelty and perfection. Now our protagonist is the bald guy here, standing. The narrative is essentially, if you don't know, I guess you can't tell, is that he has now taken up a mistress with a woman, and it persuaded the woman, who's on the ground, to leave her lover or husband, I can't remember, but in the process has killed her. And what has happened is that there are people who have now apprehended him at the site of where he has killed this woman, and they were now pilfering from his pockets the thing that he has stolen from her lover and even from her himself. So we're seeing an elevation, if you will, in cruelty. It's interesting to note, by the way, that when we watch all these movies on like serial killers and shit like that now on TV and stuff like that, they always talk about like, well, as a child, he was really mean to the neighbor's cat first, wasn't he? Don't they all sort of start that way?
Yeah.
This is the same logic, so to speak, which is a progression of cruelty.
It's in the DSM for conduct disorder, which you have to have to be a sociopath. You have to have a history of conduct disorder as a child, and it's one of the DSM-4 diagnostics.
Which is just to say that we have now institutionalized or rendered into official text what has been a long-standing sort of perception, and maybe a factually correct one at that, so to speak. So in this bottom left one, we see basically he's become kind of a cad, so to speak, taking up mistresses, stealing, murdering, if you will. I love that the portrait on the bottom left, though, reminds us very much of something not unlike out of Frankenstein or something, village pitchforks in tow, and sort of like with vigilante justice, sort of decided to apprehend him. Yeah,
the woman looks pregnant.
She might very well be. I don't know. I don't know whether that's dress or
it might be a body weight thing, but she could be pregnant.
She could be. Yeah.
Oh no, it says I'm on
Does
the
it?
Tape, I'm on the tape website.
Can
for
you
it.
See the actual prose?
Yeah. It's yeah, the prose on cruelty and perfection. Indeed, Nero's grotesque appearance conveys.
Nero, that's
yeah.
His name.
And his victim Angil, his lover and partner in crime, lies prostrate on the floor, her throat slit, her swollen stomach makes it clear that she was pregnant.
Okay, perfect. All right, Nero's his name, by the way, which. It's a good name to pick, right? You could have only done more so if you called him Caligula, I think. So Nero is the name of the guy. And now the important one I wanted you to look at is the bottom right one, which is the progression leads to. This is the reward of cruelty. Our protagonist is now the guy on the slab in the autopsy place. This location, actually, and the figure in the center is who was the president at the time of the Royal College of Surgeons in London. So what has actually happened is now this man has been tried and found guilty of the injustices he's done, the murder in particular, and he's been executed by hanging. We can tell from the noose we can see around his neck that's been cut off, the rope that's still there. And what he's been done with his body is what is done at this particular time, which is the bodies of criminals are used for autopsy at the Royal College of Surgeons. So the reward of his particular stages of cruelty has been to become a part of the institutionalization of medicine, if you will, and to become a prop in it to some degree. The portrait is kind of interesting because it looks a little bit like some of our Vesalius images that we saw, except of course, rather than being really earnest, like the Vesalius pictures are, this is satirical. So rather than being ennobling, as the Vesalius portraits looked, this one looks absolutely awful. And if there were ever moments in those anatomical texts where the body looked almost complicit in the performance, whether being animate or at least looking like, well, this ain't that bad, the way that it was posed or what have you, this is absolutely supposed to be a kind of dejected, almost strung up sort of way. I mean, to the point where he was strung up with his hang, and now he's disemboweled as though his little insides look like he's been strung out for the sake of being
honest.
What's that? His intestines?
Yeah,
the guy who's pulling them out?
Looks like.
The intestines? Me, stretch them out. It's interesting that that dog that we mentioned in the first still that was eating the other dog that was disemboweled is now eating him, so to speak, which is to say that this is very eye for an eye, so what one has done to others, he has become the victim of himself to some degree. As you can see in this last portrait, too, the reward of cruelty, there's, like in many autopsy portraits, the memento moris, in this case, the skeletons on either side pointing. And the lesson here, of course, is not just don't be cruel, but obviously there's a stakes and a degree with which one can get their comeuppance, so to speak. And the interesting thing is that the medical realm and, the in this case, the autopsy hall itself becomes a part of a particular narrative, not necessarily medical at the beginning, the first two or three plates, but absolutely at the end, its terminus. I mentioned this before, if you've seen A Rake's Progress, and we'll look at it in a little bit, there's a similar sort of use of the madhouse in the last plate of that particular narrative as well. I want to get to Rake's Progress in a second, and I wanted us to start at looking at this to consider sort of the senses of justice and the stakes of punishment, so to speak, thinking about this particular time. To that end, it's not just how severe punishment or how severe a sense of justice can be in considering the wrongdoings of somebody, the inadequacy of somebody, but the way in which the medical marketplace and the medical realm is sometimes infused in those senses of justice, inadequacy, and punishment to a certain degree, which is perfectly what takes us to Foucault. Let's pull out your copies of Madness and Civilization. I'd like to spend probably the next, maybe 20 minutes talking about the Great Confinement. Have many of you guys read much Foucault before? It's one of those people that crops up here and there in almost every discipline, but here and there, I should say. Let me give you just a quick sort of like 2 minutes on Foucault. Foucault lived from 1926 to 1984, and he's important for the fact that he was actually trained as a philosopher and a historian, although his interests seem to be wide-ranging in a much larger sense of disciplines, so that he speaks to philosophers, he speaks to historians, he speaks to literary scholars, he speaks to cultural critics, he speaks to archaeologists and to anthropologists. His work is largely translatable and relatable to all of these disciplines because the overwhelming things that Foucault were interested in are these. I would say, one, the institutionalization of power is what I think of as the first characteristic of Foucault, and the second being the structures of knowledge that we have in society. Now, Foucault, one of his famous sentiments, playing off of one made famous by Sir Francis Bacon, is, of course, knowledge is power, and power is knowledge. It's not surprising, then, that Foucault's interests are really those two variables, and in particular, how they function in these questions of institutionalization and structure. To that end, Foucault is interested not just in the ways in which power gets used and deployed, but how it gets organized, and how it gets approved and authorized within particular cultures. To that end, Foucault's largest interest in is the kind of spaces and places which dictate how power works in our culture. So I'll give you a brief rundown of some of his bibliography, just to provide you a sense of it, and tell you basically this is what the guy is interested in. His first book he wrote is the one we read from today, Madness and Civilization. Which dates from 1961. I'm giving you the dates of publication for the original French versions. Almost all of these had English translations somewhere between 4 to about 10 years afterwards, depending upon how much more popular you got in progress. So the first is Madness and Civilization. Our second is The Birth of the Clinic, which we'll be reading from next week. I'm just going to list these very quickly so we can then look at them in a list. The third is The Order of Things. From 1966. Four is Archaeology and Knowledge. It's from 1969. Then we have Discipline and Punish. 1975, is that right? Yep. And the last is a series of books he wrote on the history of sexuality, which date from 1976 until about 1984 when he died. There are three volumes that end up being critical. That would be a large, imagine this being a larger set of volumes. What I want to do is just point out to you, and I'm having to take a look at what these different structures of knowledge, power, and institutionalization mean for Foucault. Madness and Civilization is the first text that he wrote about, which is to say he's concerned with the creation and the implementation of the madhouse and the institution of insanity as not just an indication of how those who are insane are treated, but almost as a barometer or a litmus test for how we understand functional categories of normalcy or unnormalcy at a particular time, power and powerlessness. The Birth of the Clinic, which we'll talk about next week, is the creation of this very question of what does it mean to think of a distinct clinical hospital space. It's really his book about Paris medicine and the aftermath of Paris medicine. His third, The Order of Things, is about his history of thinking about how we do taxonomies. And taxonomy is not just of science and knowledge, but also of organization and bureaucracy and society. His fourth book, called Archaeology and Knowledge, is really the creation of this discipline of archaeology, in particular as it speaks to our understanding of cultures in a very distinct way in the 19th century. Discipline and Punish is his book considering why we have prisons fashioned and elaborated the way they are in the 18th and 19th centuries. In fact, of the various prisons that he studied, there's probably about, I'd say about 9 or 10 that were the major ones he focused on. One of the ones that was most central to his studies was the Eastern State Penitentiary here in Philadelphia, if anybody who had been there, where the haunted house is. Side note, I used to work at the haunted house there. That was my job for years. I loved it. It was good. It was tiring, but it was really fun. But the big thing about that prison, if you'd been there, is that it's based on the model that interested Foucault, which is the panopticon model, which is to say that it's a prison based in large part, and the reason it's so big here in Philadelphia is because of the Quakers, so that it's a prison that's there not just to punish, but to reform, if you will, persons. So its very setup is less about just confining persons than also about sort of improving their stature, having them feeling as though they're being a constant sense of surveillance. So the panopticon model of the prison is that you are, a panopticon basically means there is a central sort of rubric, and then there's all this sort of coming out like the spokes on a wheel. So that what it gives the sense of is that it's much easier to be have surveillance and to watch people, but it much more increases the sense that you are being watched even when you feel like you aren't being watched. And so the Eastern State Penitentiary is that sort of institution, if you will, at the same time. So Discipline and Punish. If you ever go to the Eastern State Penitentiary, by the way, there's a gift shop, and inside they've got like buttons and skeletons and chains and shit like that. But if you walk in, on one of the first things on the stand is like copies of Discipline and Punish by Michel Foucault. So just to give you a sense about how ingratiated it is to that institution. And the last series of books that Foucault wrote was The Histories of Sexuality, which start from classical Greek and Roman culture all the way up until probably, I think he got to about the, I until Middle Ages, I think, before he actually passed away. He passed away from AIDS in 1984. History of sexuality is concerned with the way in which, in the 19th century, we actually started to categorize and classify forms of sexuality in ways we never had before, in particular because we started to pathologize them in ways we hadn't before, which both created the language for sexualities and therefore also the categorizations of them, powering and disempowering. Now, I go through all of this not so that you feel like you've got all of Foucault in hand, but rather to see that as he moves from sexuality to the prison, to the workhouse, to the asylum, to archaeology, he may change what he's focusing on, but the stakes and the dilemmas of what he's concerned with tend to remain the same, which is to say, how do we understand power? How do we disseminate power? How do we organize power? And how do we authenticate power in each of these particular locations and institutions? To that end, we today, because we're talking about Madness in the 18th century, and appropriately in his first book, are concerned with where he started, which was, and it's interesting, that if a man should be obsessed his career with thinking how power is understood and organized, he should start with the madhouse as an institution. Yeah?
Was he really, I just briefly read something, was he himself institutionalized?
No, no.
So when they say him that, oh, maybe it's a,
they did say he had a depression.
They said he had...
Yeah.
He just had a bad depression in the sort of
sure.
attempt.
Yeah, and he's a French intellectual, so he's obsessed with psychoanalysis and Freud and all this stuff like any good French intellectual would be. So to that end, it is to say that his interest is absolutely personal in White Rise in the first book we looked at, but it's not necessarily because he himself was reared in an institution or anything like that. Let's start by looking at a few passages in Madness and Civilization then. As we'll see here, a history of insanity in the age of reason. We're still here then in this age of reason, this age of enlightenment at this time. It's interesting then, so that what happens is, in trying to consider how the enlightenment in the age of reason has a tendency to affirm or decry certain forms of identity and certain forms of power and knowledge, that the asylum should be the galvanizing force, not just to approve some of those different identities, but actually to punish some of them as well. Let's look at maybe about four passages on there, because what I want you to get in hand is what is the central thesis of what Foucault is arguing in The Great Confinement. And in particular, what does that mean, not so much about institutions of insanity, but what it means about what's happening outside the walls of these madhouses. For it is significant that Foucault's interest in any of these topics is not just these topics in and of themselves, but what they actually say in a much larger sense about how we understand sexualities or identities. So his interest in the history of sexuality might, for example, be largely interested in, say, when was the homosexual created and how we defined that person? But his interest is not just for the sake of knowing how we understand homosexuality, but that in studying that we actually see how heterosexuality itself might have been appreciated, or bisexuality, or transsexuality, or any other identity. So an interest in insanity is to say, how do we confine, define, and prescribe what insanity is? It might tell us a lot about what we also consider normality at a particular time. Let's start on page 38. This is chapter 2, the central sort of chapter of the text called The Great Confinement. I will tell you this about Foucault, and I'm going to tell you a few things that I think about him, because Foucault is one of those figures that I think we medical historians and we cultural critics all love, but also all sort of poo-poo at the same time, too. So significant and central is he, but so hog-tied do we feel to him sometimes, because he's so significant in how he galvanizes principles. I just want you to notice that The Great Confinement is what this chapter is called, and I just want you to note that Foucault, one of his greatest strengths is his eloquence, his ability both in turn of phrase and also an ambition of concept to really galvanize the general construct that's happening in a historical moment, really to give it a kind of panache like nobody can. But he's also somebody who can't ever do anything with subtlety, hence this title's chapter.
The Great Confinement, men.
is how it's supposed to be read. So let's read what the first sentence and paragraph is of this section. By a strange act of force, the classical age was reduced to silence, the madness whose voices the Renaissance had just liberated, but whose violence it had already tamed. I should tell you that, and this bears in mind what we're going to read in a second in this article, Scholarship of Fools, Foucault begins Madness and Civilization in the first chapter with a riff on the concept of the ship of fools. Does everybody know what the ship of fools is as a euphemism?
No.
It's basically a either apocryphal or factual sort of anecdote about what we do with people that we think are fools or criminals or people who are of ill repute in a particular culture. The notion of the ship of fools is we put them on a ship and sort of kick them off adrift away out of town, so to speak. So there's this idea that we need to eject, deject, so to speak, certain persons, but more importantly, we also need to confine them. The ship of fools is a central sort of concept for Foucault, and it's actually one that speaks a lot to also histories of how we deal with contagious diseases, too, like leprosy. Lepers were often referred to as having to be sent off on a ship of fools. So that what we're concerned with is not just contagion in that to that degree, and not just also ejection or jettisoning of ill repute persons, but also containing. The ship is a supporting metaphor for Foucault, not just because it tends to get rid of persons, but it also contains them at the same time on a single vessel. And for him, this is what the sort of perfect sort of metaphor to think about the madhouse is. It both takes people out of the normal structures and places of society, but also confines them in a certain way. We'll see why he revisits this later in Discipline and Punish, when it comes to actual criminals, if you will. But the madhouse becomes for him an important space then to, with force, contain, if you will, certain types of individuals. Now, he's described here, the classical age was to reduce to silence the madness whose voices the Renaissance had just liberated. The classical age he's referring to here is this age of reason, this age of the Enlightenment, if you will. Coming just after the Renaissance, as we talked about, such an emphasis on reason for Foucault in the Enlightenment after the Renaissance has therefore predicated that we need not value just artistic liberty, creativity, vitality, if you will, is what he's saying the Renaissance value, but that actually we need to highlight above any other principle reason, structure, character, moral and psychological fortitude, if you will. So those that don't live up to that standard then become the ones that we deem as less than. To that degree, for Foucault, in his wide general sort of assessment of a distinction between the Renaissance and the Age of Reason, is to say there's a whole bunch of gifts that would have been really embraced in the Renaissance. For the first time, creativity, eccentricities of different kinds, that now in the Age of Reasons are being squelched. So for a long time they weren't given praise. And in the Renaissance there was a little room where somebody who had a love eccentricity in a time that was seen as vitality could have really been rewarded. Now in the Age of Reason is seen as the worst kind of culprit for not being a model and emblematic of reason. To that end, this is a period, this great confinement, where the treatment of mad people is not just emblematic of how we treat the insane, but it's emblematic of what we appreciate in all persons. So for Foucault, not surprisingly, if he's interested in this particular era, which is this historical specific era, he chooses the insane as a central figure for his first book, because how we treat the insane is how we treat everybody for him at this particular time. The madhouse then becomes not a special institution, but it becomes an emblematic institution of how we treat or don't treat certain people of different classes. Let's turn to page 41. And this is where I can use a volunteer to read for me. It's the paragraph that begins at the bottom of the page, the structure proper to the monarchical and bourgeois order of France. And just that whole paragraph. Would somebody care to read for us? Thank you, Erwin.
The structure proper to the monarchical and bourgeois order of France, contemporary with some occasion absolutist form, soon extended its network over the whole of France. An edict of the king, dated June 16, 1676, prescribed the establishment of an hôpital général in each city of his kingdom. Occasionally, the measure had been anticipated by the local authorities. The bourgeoisie of Lyon had already organized in 1612 a charity establishment that functioned in an analogous manner. The Archbishop of Tours was proud to declare on July 10, 1676, that his archiepiscopal city has happily foreseen the pious intentions of the king and erected an hôpital général called the Charité, even before the one in Paris. His order has served as a model for all those subsequently established within or outside the kingdom. The Charité of Tours, in fact, had been founded in 1656. The king endowed it with an income of 4,000 livres. Over the entire face of France, hôpitaux généraux were opened on the eve of the revolution. They were to be found in 32 provincial cities.
Okay, I wanted to have us read this, and if you make a note to yourself, if you turn to page 53, there's a little bit more that describes in detail the l'hôpital général of France. I just want to introduce this concept to us because it's central to today's discussion, and big time central to next week when we talk about the work at the clinic. But in thinking of the l'hôpital général are significant because they're general hospitals, as it looks like is what it says there, But significant because while they're general hospitals open to the public, and that's the significant part of the L'Hôpital General, they're also hospital institutions that are significant because they also have an authority that comes into cry by the state. To that degree, it's a kind of new organization and new authorization of hospital systems in France at this particular time. Now, it's going to become very significant when we get to Paris Medicine next week in terms of how these are deployed and exacerbated and how they're used with the rise of Paris Medicine. But Foucault's point here, and our point for this week, is the fact that there's the creation of these particular kinds of hospitals, hospitals that are created for the services of communities that are organized regionally for the services of particular communities and are there to supplant the needs of the community for those that they can't handle through their own charitable institutions. To that end, the L'Hôpital General becomes important not just because of the fact that it's a government or political or municipal sort of institution, but the fact that it's there to actually provide not only structure and support, but also a degree of authority, of demarcating between who is in need of medical assistance and who is not in need of medical assistance, aside from the usual rubrics of charity and philanthropy, if you will. Foucault isolates, and part of his theory of madness and civilization is that with the rise of the L'Hôpital General, there is a demand on the part of French government to realize that there are certain persons who, whatever the structures are within societies and communities, who aren't being met their needs, either for the benefit of those individuals or to curtail the weight that comes on societies at large. This will be important because one of Foucault's points in thinking about the great confinement in the 17th and 18th centuries in France and elsewhere is to suggest that prior to this era, this classical age that he calls it, a person that could have been deemed the village idiot, or the town retard, or the person who's slow in that community, all of these debased terms, would have been somebody who would have been cared for, tended, or at least tolerated in that particular community as just a part of the community, whether out of charity or just out of normalcy, and seeing that person as an anomaly and yet a normal kind of anomaly within a community. With the rise of the L'Hôpital General, in the age of reason, these individuals, having to be held to a particular standard of enlightenment and reason, are now seen as a burden in the way that they weren't seen before. And the L'Hôpital General come together not just to meet that need, but almost to organize it at the same time. The significance then of the L'Hôpital General, and by extension asylums for Foucault, is not that they just sort of generate out of nowhere, but they generate at a time when reason is given primacy, because it has power, and that the structure or institutionalization of it becomes a hospital or later an asylum. Why that's significant then is that in an age of reason, when enlightenment is really touching on what is considered valorizing in so many different ways, it's the madhouse that becomes the supplement to a community in France to provide for those who don't live up to that psychological, that reason, or that enlightened sort of standard. Turning to page 46, notice, by the way, too, that Foucault's discussion on 41, 42 leads right into this question where he talks about the bottom of 43 in italicized terms, houses of correction. There's a kind of dovetailing that happens in Foucault's discussions in France and then later in other societies about what does the asylum mean and what does other places that look like it mean. So, for example, what does a poorhouse look like? Or what does a prison look like? Or what does a jail look like? And how those look similar or dissimilar to asylum speaks to not just the way we treat the insane, but also how we determine who qualifies within what kind of space or another. Looking on page 46, this is sort of a central tenet of the article, or this chapter, so I'm going to read this out loud. This is the great confinement, and this is the paragraph where he speaks specifically about what constitutes confinement. Page 46, right after the break. Confinement. Notice the bombastic rhetoric in Foucault, which is part of his stuff and ash, but it's also part of why he has such longevity in terms of why we still read him. Confinement, that massive phenomenon, the signs of which are found all across 18th century Europe, is a police matter. Police in the precise sense that the classical epoch gave to it, that is, the totality of measures which make work possible and necessary for all those who could not live without it. The question Voltaire would soon formulate, Colbert's contemporaries had already asked, since you have established yourselves as a people, had you not yet discovered the secret of forcing all the rich to make all the poor work? Are you still ignorant of the first principles of the police? Before having the medical meaning we give it, or that at least we like to suppose it has, confinement was required by something quite different from any concern with curing sick. What made it necessary was an imperative of labor. Our philanthropy prefers to recognize the signs of benevolence towards sickness, where there is only a condemnation of idleness. I'm going to read that last sentence again because it really is the fulcrum of what he's writing. Foucault is not somebody who I would say is absolutely a Marxist, but he's somebody who recognizes that power, as he understands it, and its relationship to economy is very hard to divorce. So he says here at the end, what I just read, before having the medical meaning we give it, or that at least we like to suppose it has, confinement, institutional confinement, madhouse confinement, was required by something quite different from any concern with curing the sick. What made it necessary was an imperative of labor. Our philanthropy prefers to recognize the signs of a benevolence towards sickness, where there is only a condemnation of idleness. So let's put these two terms up. Sickness and idleness. These are the two terms that Foucault provides for us. Our philanthropic tendency wants to think that we're there and building institutions to help the sick to some degree. What he's suggesting is that we're there to house the idle, if you will, to some degree. To that end, the madhouse becomes a place less of reform and less of healing than it is of really containing, or at the very least, galvanizing those who are idle and making them somehow valuable to some degree. Taking them away from the productive part of society so they don't infect them or strip their resources, if you will, to some degree, or putting them in, ideally in an asylum, a circa workhouse, we might actually put them to use in some particular way. You'll notice that a lot of this doesn't sound that different from lots of histories of penal reform, to think what can we do with people of ill repute in a society to either reform them or punish them, or in some way make them still a central part of society. For Foucault, the great confinement is significant not because of the fact that it happened on such a large scale, although he argues this, that it was so cruel, although he argues this, but the fact that it was done under such false pretenses, that it was meant to have been done for the benefit of treating and curing individuals, when in fact it was meant to treat and protect the wants and needs of society. Turning to page 49, he states in the middle of this page, throughout Europe, and we'll get in a little bit to this happening throughout all of Europe and everywhere in Europe this thing is, throughout Europe, confinement had the same meaning, at least if we consider its origin. It constituted one of the answers the 17th century gave to an economic crisis that affected the entire Western world. Reduction of wages, unemployment, scarcity of coin, the coincidence of these phenomena probably being due to a crisis in the Spanish economy. Now, the specifics of the Spanish economy or the English economy at this time are less important than the fact that we are talking about a crisis in economy at the time in terms of work, labor, resources, services. We talked a lot about this idea that there was a period in the Enlightenment before the Renaissance where there's a real galvanizing sort of feeling about national sentiment owing a lot to advances in technology, advances in shipping, advances in empire. And to that degree, these are strains, economical on culture. We even saw, looking at Defoe in Journal of the Plague year, that one of the major variables that even he identified for why plague can happen at a particular moment is a straining, if you will, on some of the resources at a particular city and time. So to that end, the economic variables that are straining certain advancements in culture's expansions, if you will, have not created the stakes that caused the Great Confinement, but they've created the groundwork that would make something like idleness become one of the gravest sins you can do to a particular society, or not being a productive member, if you will. To that degree, the freedom, the liberty, the free roaming of an insane or a less than sane person, a less than reasonable one, becomes a threat to the reason, the age of reason of a time, but also the economic viability of a particular community, or at least that's the way it's fashioned. It's part of the way these L'Hôpital Général in France are sold, and it's the way workhouses and such are also sold throughout other parts of Europe. Turn to page 51. I just want to take you one more moment before we talk a bit more about this. Page 51, this is where it becomes important. Outside of the periods of crisis, confinement acquired another meaning. Its repressive function was combined with a new use. It was no longer merely a question of confining those out of work, but of giving work to those who had been confined and thus making them contribute to the prosperity of all. The alternation is clear. Cheap manpower in the periods of full employment and high salaries, and in periods of unemployment, reabsorption of the idle and social protection against agitation and uprisings. Now this is kind of significant here, since what we're talking about is totally that logic of somebody who can't contribute to a society, who may not have somebody to take care of them, who is mentally deficient. Let's see if we can't institutionalize that person, whatever their mental deficiency, whether it's developmental disability, whether it's schizophrenia or whatever it would have been called at the time, or some kind of hysteria. Let's see if we can't put them to some valuable work in an asylum or a poorhouse. It's partly that. But Foucault, there's a kind of cultural paranoia that's actually just as important as the need to put people to work or to institutionalize them. For him, it's not just a repressive function. It's not just we need to corral and put away insane people so their voices can't be heard, or because we need to control them. And it's not just that we need to put them to work because they can't be idle. It's definitely both of those. So know that it's repressive, and know that it's about making the idle not idle. But the other thing is about quenching agitation and uprising, what he says at the end there. To that degree, the asylum becomes important for Foucault because it's not just where we put mad people, it's not just what we do with the mad people when they're there, and it's not even just the grounds that they're there. It's what constitutes somebody being described as unreasonable or insane at this particular moment. Idleness is part of what he's talking about, but that idleness comes in many forms. So for Foucault, it is this. The Great Confinement was a period with which, for him, masses of persons were institutionalized systematically, for him, throughout Europe, in ways they hadn't been before. The ways they hadn't been before were in actual asylums. Asylums had existed in isolation at different moments throughout Western history and Western medicine, but this was a very structured, comprehensive sort of movement. So they were isolated, they were institutionalized in buildings, they were put to work, or at least under the grounds that they needed to be put to work, and fourthly, were the grounds with which they were institutionalized to begin with. And in those grounds could be the person was slow, the person was crazy, the person was mentally deficient, the person had political leanings that were unsympathetic, the person was sexually seen as a deviant in some particular ways, the person was ethnically or racially deficient in some particular fascination at this particular time, the person had logics or blasphemous feelings that could have within their own community or larger sense been seen to some degree as touching on madness, or any other permutations. To that degree, the madhouse becomes not the place where people are confined when they don't, when they fit a particular criteria of what constitutes abnormal. It's that they get put in there when they don't live up to a particular criterion of what constitutes normal. So the madhouse becomes, for Foucault, and as we will see, he's correct in some ways, a place where we put beggars, and we put mad persons, and we put homosexuals, and we put drag queens, and we put prostitutes, and we put criminals, and we put homicidal persons, and we put suicidal persons. It becomes a kind of catch-all for all of the social ills that we feel are insufficient or deficient. So it speaks to the way with which we can get out of the normal society, the people we don't like, get them out of the public eye. It can have us put them to good use in an age of reason when idleness is not a good thing. And it has us also condemn forms of political, sexual, personal sort of identity that we think are deficient or insufficient. Now, Foucault senses that this is happening on a mass scale all across Europe in a major significant sort of way. That's not exactly true. But his point that there's a beginning to want to methodologically sort of think about corralling, containing, institutionalizing persons is absolutely a distinction. Not so much of France, maybe not even so much of all of Europe, but of the spirit of the age of reason, it absolutely is, in a way that we haven't seen before in the history of medicine. Any questions about this Great Confinement? Yeah.
I think you're making this clear with what you said, but in reading it, it wasn't totally clear to me. It seems that there is a distinction between medical illness and what you just described, social lack of coming up to standards.
Yeah.
So if someone had, let's say, an infectious disease,
yeah,
they're not put in the hospital, or they're put. Are they put somewhere else, or are they cared for in the community still?
They can be put in, for instance, L'Hôpital General, we're talking, again, this is the hard part. If we're talking about France,
right.
I will tell you from my own experience and research, the L'Hôpital General is a place where absolutely somebody who's contagious can be taken. The L'Hôpital General are significant, by the way, too, in the sense that they existed for a couple of centuries up until about the 17th century, but it wasn't until this time that they started to be seen as an institutional, wide-reaching, sort of organized by region. And the first time they were actually segregated into curable and uncurable sort of camps within there. So there could be epidemiological reasons with which one person could be in there. They are a place to actually do a kind of healing, if you will. Having said that, their implementation for the purpose of institutionalizing the insane becomes its majority sort of purpose at this particular time. And that signifies not so much a supplanting of the epidemiological with the insane, but almost a kind of fusion, if you will, to some degree. And the reason that people get institutionalized at the level of why they're insane, for all kinds of social ills, suggests that what has been a kind of methodology at the level of how to deal with a kind of pathology, epidemiology with persons, has been used in the service of the like, social, political, sort of different kinds of ills, if you will.
So
what had been a metaphorical social ill had now become a literal one.
Right.
Yeah, and through this kind of institution.
Okay.
If you look on pages 60 and 61, I'm not going to read this out loud right now. What I want you to read are two particularly good paragraphs in here. The first is on page 60 that starts an important phenomenon, and then the paragraph that after it says, thus we see inscribed. This is two paragraphs that Foucault basically talks about what had been a function of institutional enforcement and an institutional medicine, and what had been a standard for dealing with social and morals at a particular time had now become synonymous in a new way, unlike ever before, so to speak. The great confinement then not being the creation of new standards, but rather the intolerance and treatment of those standards in a way that had never been before. It's almost the generation of these particular kinds of institutions made possible an implementation of punishment or confinement that would have been liked in the past but not been possible before. I want to turn really quickly to this article by Andrew Skoll that I gave you.
On the same paragraph here, it says, let them learn once and for all that everything can be had for money except morals. I understand that part. But what about citizens? What's he covering there?
The last part with a quote from,
let's see here, let all cultures leave the country.
Is he saying that you can buy anything, and buy morals, but you, citizens can be bought.
Well, maybe it means you can't become a citizen by paying? I don't know.
Well, either you can't be a citizen by paying, or more importantly, and this has become kind of significant when we look at one of these particular texts in the Madhouse, which is to say, what constitutes a citizen changes, so to speak. And to say that morals and citizenry can be flexible in terms of who qualifies under both, who can be punished under both as well. It's why, I'll tell you in a second, it's why when we have this particular, blah, 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 Alexander Cruden's, it's called The London Citizen Exceedingly Injured. The point being that to be put into a madhouse is to have been almost deemed no longer a citizen of proper society. And that journal that we read is actually about him being sort of angry about the fact that he shouldn't have been institutionalized to begin with. In its very title, The Invocation of Citizens, suggesting I have been misclassified, if you will, to some degree. This quote by Foucault at the end suggesting that if you are a citizen, it shouldn't be up for sale. But if you don't qualify under that particular label, you're screwed, so to speak.
Okay.
I want to look quickly, though, at this Scholarship of Fools article and just direct you towards a couple of paragraphs because it really speaks to what's significant. Now, the history of madness as Foucault understands it, and the great confinement as he lays it out, is significant and has had such long legs coming from the 1960s even to now, because it really is a great sort of principle with which for us to think about this large swath of time and what it is about the rise of the madhouse and the way that we understand different forms of normalcy, abnormalcy, deviancy, propriety, you name it, in a way that was really significant at the time. So Foucault's exaggerated, bombastic, loud, magnanimous sort of like description of it suits the stakes that are actually changing at the time. Now the problem is when you get to the specifics, when you actually look at the numbers in terms of how many people were institutionalized in France or elsewhere, how many different kinds of persons in a particular institution could have been deemed mad, according to the way that Foucault describes. How long did this go on the way that Foucault said it did? How many different people were deploying this kind of policing within a specific society? The truth of the matter is that critics of the Great Confinement and of Foucault's Medicine Civilization go back almost as long as that book, in particular as long as that book has been published in English. It was first printed in 1961 in French, first published in English, don't hold me to this, but I think like 72. I think it was almost 10 years before it was translated into English in the translation that you have in front of you. Now, when it was printed in English and translated, it was also abridged. The original book, Histoire de la Folie, as Foucault wrote it, was The History of Madness, was probably, I think, like 500 or 600 pages long. It was a big sucker. Then it got translated to English, and it was like 250 pages or something. So critics, when it first got published in English, tended to point to, I'm actually a history of madness in England, and I'm noticing confinement in a way that we haven't known before, just as you described it in Foucault, but I would probably describe it as great. You know, so they might look at a year that Foucault says it was really bad in 1722 to 1728, and then they may look in the English record and it was like, well, there were 10 more people institutionalized those years in the 10 years prior, so I'm not sure how that's great. or they might critique Foucault's history of madness because, or madness and civilization, because they might find that they don't see continuities across all of Europe. As even though those passages reread out loud, Foucault was like, and we see this throughout Western Europe, throughout all of the continent. A lot of historians, Dutch, German, some French, a lot of English, are saying, I'm not seeing it as big as you're saying you're seeing it. I can see the variables, and I can see the stakes here, but I'm not seeing it as big. This article by Andrew Scull, that I had to read, is significant because the rebuttal to those critiques of Foucault was always, well, you need to read the whole thing in the original French, Histoire de Folie, you know? And because it had never been translated in full, it was always assumed that there was this great tome of other support and documentation out there to support this. Well, it was translated in full into English within the past 5 to 8 years or so, and this is an article commemorating that. Scull basically writing with to say that the fault that we had with Madness and Civilization in those 250 pages, we now have the entire 600 in Histoire de Folie to look at, and we now have 600 pages with the same faults, basically, which is to say, and it doesn't surprise me at all, because I've read everything by Foucault, and let me tell you this, Foucault is a great writer, a great theorist, a great thinker of ideas, and a terrible historian. He is terrible. He's awful. He will go to the archive and find two examples and be like, yep, that's how it was in the 20th century. Like, the whole thing. So the thing about, and this is my anecdote when I talk about the Great Confinement, is that it was a great confinement in terms of the methodology and the rubric with which certain persons were confined. But it was not great in terms of how many people were institutionalized in the 18th century compared to the century before. It was not great in terms of how many more madhouses there were. There were different kinds, but the truth of the matter is that what we call the workhouse or what we call the jailhouse had just been relabeled an asylum, so it really wasn't that big of a structural change. It wasn't that great in terms of its national and geographic breadth as we think it is. It wasn't that great in the sense that you would go to an asylum and see 500 different kinds of people that are there for 500 different reasons. Probably not. What was great about it was the fact that, as he describes it in its worst exaggerated case, it could possibly be the case at that time in a way that it couldn't have been before. And that's made possible by the Age of Reason. The anecdote I like to give is that Foucault thinks this is happening throughout all of Europe. The truth of the matter is that it's only happening in France, in one town, on the East End, in one building, on the third floor, at the end, in the last room. To one person. That's, one could do that sort of thing. That Foucault takes the small evidentiary sort of moment and blows it up to great proportion. But thankfully, that magnification is precisely what provides the fact that we're still talking about it all these years later, because it provides a wonderful sort of like bouncing off point, sounding board, if you will, of how to think about the history of madness. To that end, what's interesting about madness and civilization, what's interesting about the Great Confinement, is that it's almost a historiographical attempt on the part of the historian to want to see a great confinement that may have only been suggested at or hinted at that moment. And it does not make the suggestion or the isolated examples of it any less horrific than it happened. We certainly have read the accounts of it. It just means that there's a historiographical imperative on Foucault's part to want to see a greater injustice that may have been there. Not that the injustices that happened weren't ungreat or what have you, but rather that they linger large despite the fact that they may have been isolated to that particular moment. I just want to direct you towards a couple of the critiques that we get from Scull in this little piece. On page 2 that I have numbered down here, 2 of 7, if you want a little bit of a backstory, if you haven't read this yet, the first two full paragraphs on this page provide a summation of Madness and Civilization when it was first printed, and that it was very short and people wanted it to have extra things in it, but it didn't. Turning to page 5, the bottom of page 5, there's a couple of paragraphs that mention some of the estimations that Foucault makes about the Great Confinement throughout Europe, and there's a couple of English examples provided that are kind of refuting some of that theory in its most exaggerated sort of form. So if you want to look at a couple of examples, there's two at the bottom of page 5. And the last thing I would have you look at is the last two paragraphs of the actual article, the penultimate one, the second to last one, even beginning. Such massive incarceration simply never occurred in England in the 17th and 18th centuries. Whether one focuses on one's attention on the mad, who were still mostly left at large, or on the broader category of the poor, the idle, and the morally disreputable, which is to say that what's debatable here is not the confinement, I didn't write it up there, the confinement that Foucault talks about, but how great it really was to some degree. To that end, what I want us to do actually is now then look at some of those specific moments and think about, well, and this is kind of for those of you who want to do that question, was the 18th century a disaster for the insane? One could say in the same way that great confinement was not great, that it wasn't really a disaster either. But both of those depend on, well, define disaster for me then. Or in the case of Foucault's great confinement, define great for me. I like the great confinement as a theory because I don't think Foucault got the theory wrong. I think he just got the word great wrong. He wanted it to mean all of geography of Western Europe, or all institutions in one place, or all forms of madness. And the fact of the matter is, those confinements could have been great just on their own stakes. Yeah?
One thing I'm curious is, Foucault obviously has a point he wants to defend, whether the facts get in the way or not, that this was a very malevolent movement on the part of society. And yet, but I wondered, was there any foundation of the concept of l'hôpital in the medieval l'hôpitalier, who were people who ran basically inns that would take in pilgrims or the indigent, which was then, it was paternalist, but it was also a benevolent
object
as well.
Yeah.
And was there benevolence associated with this, or is it really as malevolent as Foucault seems to want it?
The malevolence he sees, now these l'hôpital général are the sort of like after children, if you will, of those places that you're talking about, which is to say, both in name and also in sort of like location, if you will. And the intention being that they're supposed to be houses of benevolence, if you will. And there is some benevolence that are there. Now, speaking of the ones that you're talking about earlier, we could describe and look at a specific one, whether we call them benevolent or not. The important thing to know is that we can absolutely say they're charitable, that their motivation, their funding is absolutely philanthropic. And in fact, one of the big differences is that what was a l'hôpital prior to here, what became a l'hôpital général, is not so much who was treated or how was treated, or whether or not it was benevolent, but who's bankrolling this thing. And rather than being a charity or a church, it's now become the state to some degree. So how benevolent it is might depend case to case, but whether it constitutes this charitable thing might be the bigger linchpin to make there. Before we look at some of these accounts of madness, let's go back to Hogarth. And let's take a look at a rake's progress. Unless anybody has any more questions. Okay, so we had the four stages of cruelty. This one is called a rake's progress, and by the way, there's also a female counterpart called a harlot's progress. Basically, young girl, little loose, comes a whore, dies, syphilis, I think something like that, I can't forget, but all in six paintings, you know, something like that. And so, this is our eighth painting, A Rake's Progress. Does everybody know what a rake is? Like a womanizer, or a cad, or what's the word for a rake?
Libertine,
that's the one I was thinking of, yeah. So anyway, somebody who's hedonistic, morally questionable, possibly debonair, but probably rotten from the inside out, you know what I mean? So this is A Rake's Progress. Plate number one. The young heir takes possession of the miser's effects. With the protagonist, of course, in this particular narrative, it's the rake himself. And this is the guy in the middle getting measured, this young man. And we can see here that he has inherited the effects of the miser. And so what's happening in this portrait? Let's see. He's being tailored, measured for clothes. What else? Someone is crying. Looting, yeah, it's totally looting. I mean, to the point where paintings are being taken off walls and materials are being collected. You get the sense that the woman on the right, either the maid or the mistress or the handywoman or something of the person who's passed, is grieving for the way that this whole apartment is being pillaged, if you will, to some degree. What's that?
They could also be that the women are being turned out because they're having a husband as a protector.
Totally.
The widow and daughter being turned out by this very unfeeling young man.
Totally. Whatever it is, lady on the right, she's getting the shaft. We have that for sure. Mm-hmm. Fun fact, anybody wants to know, when I was in college, I had a job. I worked at Colonial Williamsburg. I wore the outfit the man is wearing right now, being measured with, or what have you. Totally. I grew up in Virginia. It was a summer job. I worked at a tavern, Shooting's Tavern. Worked there for a summer. Wore the whole outfit. It was hot. It was like real bold, like authentic 18th century. Yeah, totally. And two fun stories. One, I made a shitload of money because it was like working with people on vacation, so they're a little bit nicer, I guess tipping wise or whatever. It was hard work. Anybody who's waiting tables knows this. And the other thing was, I got a lot better tips if I did a little bit of a Southern accent or an English one. And the Southern one, I think, because people coming from like Jersey and New York wanted to become a little Southern hospitality in Virginia, and the English one because I guess they wanted to step back into the 18th century. But I'm terrible at accents, but it didn't matter, so anything close.
Well, how are you?
Bye-bye.
So you went from being dressed as like a rape to working in a madhouse?
I know, it did.
Is that correct?
I know, isn't this funny? I have two stories on this. Yeah. So the English accent I was really bad at, but totally. Now here's the other thing too. So I totally worked there, it was like 10 years ago. And the other thing was that people took their picture with me constantly. Can we get a picture with you? Can we get a picture with you? I am dying. It still hasn't happened yet, but I am waiting for the day, like when I have a student or something, and they're like, "You look so familiar." And I'm waiting for the like, "Oh my God, turn our family photo up." Because I know I've been hundreds of them across the country, so to speak. It hasn't happened, but I do know that when I teach undergrads, that they're kind of right about that age, where they were probably about 8 or 9 when I used to work there, when they were being taken on family trips. So I'm like right in that window where. Oh, I'm hoping. I don't know. Anyway, so that's going away from Twitter. All right, let's look at the next few fights.
Why is it a miser? Why is it a miser's effect?
That he gets the major effects? I don't know. I guess one would be the sense that we have somebody that he's getting an abundance just in that fact. So if it's somebody who's a bit of a hoarder or what have you, you know, or somebody who holds on to things, then that means that we know that he's inherited a lot, might be part of it. And I guess also just to suggest that we're inheriting somebody who in principle is very different. The tainting isn't of the money that he's gotten, because somebody has gotten it and held on to it. The part about this guy is that he's going to blow through it in about 3 paintings. We're going to find, you know? So, plate 2, surrounded by artists and professors. So this is him with that weird hat in the middle and that little sort of, with his legs sort of turned out. What do you call that in ballet when you're like this? Yeah, thank you. So this is him, surrounded by artisans. He's kind of in a salon, if you will. We can see that he has basically taken the affects and the money he's garnered and sort of tried to put himself into a certain class in society. Largely probably bought him, we can see here. Plate 3, the tavern scene, which we can now see that his true character as a man of ill repute is sort of coming through since he's blowing through his money in the tavern house, filled with wanton women and men and wine and gambling and all sorts of questionable things of character. Plate 4, he is now arrested for debt. So we can see that he has now gone through all of the money and the miser's effects, and now he is going to be arrested. Plate 5 is married to an old maid. So this is him with the wig on in front of the deacon, chaplain, whomever, holding the book for the marriage ceremony, and the beautiful woman on his right arm. We can see the old woman. So he has now taken to. I think I've heard also too that in the back there are 3 women that are fighting back there. Mm-hmm. These 3 women being much younger, more attractive women who may have been mistresses or lovers of him. And this, in the same way that he has refused to marry any of them, they're fighting with each other sort of over his affections, what have you. It's kind of like when you see like Maury or something and like they come out on stage and like they just sort of pull each other's hair, you know, like a little bit. Plate 6, scene in a gaming house. So now we can see that he's actually moved, migrated, if he was in a tavern before, towards an actual sort of like, you call it a casino or gambling house. Plate 7, the prison scene. And this is a debtor's prison, this scene here. And it's not uncommon, actually. See how he's there with like, there's young children and women and all that sort of thing. Debtor's prisons at that particular time actually often housed families. They were less a place to just sort of lock up a person who hadn't paid their debts than it was to say, we're going to claim all the possessions that you have and now we're going to put you in kind of temporary housing if you were somebody's prison, no less. But very often you could be there housed with your family. So that's part of the insinuation here. Suggestion also just being too that there's a degree of being locked up, if you will, for the infractions and character that he has. Which brings us to the last scene, which is in the madhouse. This madhouse in particular is Bethlehem Hospital. Which is in London. Bethlehem Hospital dates from about the 13th century as a hospital in general for treatment. Occasionally for treatments of psychological or insanity reasons, but largely it's the General Hospital of London. Starting in about 1700, though, it becomes one of the primary places, once it gets relocated to a location, for treating the insane, Bethlehem Hospital does. So in the 18th and 19th centuries, then, Bethlehem Hospital is kind of the standard touchstone for what it is to have somebody be institutionalized in the London and jurisdiction surrounding areas. It's in fact where we get the term bedlam. When we say that something is chaotic or out of control, or something in a state of bedlam. Bedlam is a corruption of the word Bethlehem. So Bethlehem and Bedlam are sort of the same standard thing. So Bethlehem Hospital then becomes, because of the new grounds it's built on, in this particular era in 1700, and they're just outside of the city, it becomes the emblematic sort of perfect thing of a different kind of confinement. Great or not, as you want to call it to some degree. So looking at this particular plate, the rake is the figure in the front, now bald. We can see her lying down. What I wanted to point out and look at here was what Hogarth's representation of Bethlehem Hospital looks like. Now, his representation of this would have been based not just on cultural euphemism and understanding, but also upon eyewitness sort of testimony. Bethlehem Hospital, like a lot of famous institutions in France, Germany, and England in the 17th and 18th century, was significant because of the fact that it was open to the public, in the sense that you could pay for a small fee the ability to come and tour the madhouse, to see the kinds of people that were there, and potentially to sort of just sort of gawk at them, if you will, to some degree. There's a great play called Marat Sade, if anybody knows this play, which is a basic, what's the long title? The Persecution and Assassination of Jean-Paul Marat, as dramatized by the inmates of Charenton Prison by the Marquis de Sade. I think that's the full title. Which is to say, it's a play that's about somebody who's been institutionalized, Marat, a famous person from the French Revolution, and his life is being dramatized by the Marquis de Sade, for the benefit of the public who've come in to watch the play. So there's some other words. It's a play from the 60s that's about people putting on a play in a madhouse for the general public. And it's very counterculture 60s-esque then. But anyway, the premise of that is the same as this, which is to say, what is it like to look at people in a madhouse? What I want to look at is, who are these people that are in here? So let's sort of work our way through and look at all the people that are there. If Foucault talks about a great confinement, and one of those greatnesses he says is geographic, which was heard not true, and is great in terms of how many people are there, which is probably not true, he also means great, though, in terms of how many different kinds of people can be put in a madhouse. And maybe he's true, but this portrait seems to suggest that there was at least some contemporary feeling that one could be put in a madhouse for all different kinds of reasons. So let's start our way off the right, working to the left. What are the things we would prescribe as why these persons are in the institution? Let's start with the guy on the right, with the hat, the dunce hat. What do we think he's there for?
He's an idiot.
He's an idiot. I think he's also somebody who's got delusions of grandeur in some way, right? Like somebody who thinks he's the king, or maybe he's a papist. He could be there for Catholic sympathies, you know? You know, he's like the person who, like, what is this? When someone, they think they go crazy, and they think there's somebody else, but they think they're the Archduke Ferdinand or something crazy like that. It's not just that they think there's somebody else, but how elevated the person they think they are. The person on the steps in front of him?
Depressed.
Depression, dejection, malaise, English malady, you name it. I'm not sure, although I think if it was English malady, he'd probably be outside for being praised for the having that attribute. Next to that person with the violin?
Eccentric,
fool? Something, right? I mean, the violin is one thing, the book on the head is another, right?
Other touch.
Yeah, so we get the sense that this is a sort of lewd, right? How about the two ladies?
Touring
madhouse. Absolutely. There tends to be two theories about these women. One, they're touring the madhouse, or two,
they're like weird twins or something?
Well, or just, sorry. They're whores.
Oh,
ooh. You know? Yeah, I mean, whores that are there because they're whores, or whores that are there because they broke the law, or whores that are there because they've gone mad from syphilis, or who's not sure. So they're either to the touchstones to touring the place or being there for some circumstantial reason. Yeah.
Is there any idea that they would be homosexual?
Yeah.
I've never heard that before. Although I've certainly speculated about whether that could be the case, and certainly anybody with any kind of homosexual or transgender sort of leaning certainly have been grounds for being institutionalized at this time, but I don't know. I'm not sure. In front of that person, holding the
sausage
and testicles, I don't know, holy right? I mean, one can't refute the fact that this looks like a court jester, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So one gets the sense of nothing else than he's just something of an ass, you know? So maybe he's there for being the idiot. Yeah.
He kind of looks short. Would somebody who is physically like a dwarf be institutionalized?
Is he what?
Could he be a dwarf? Would somebody with dwarfism be institutionalized?
No, because a dwarf person actually wouldn't have been institutionalized for that alone. In fact, a dwarf person would have been appreciated, to be frank, as something of a cultural anomaly in sort of a fascinating way. So, for example, it was common at this time, as it was going back to even Tudor Elizabethan England, to have dwarfs as a member of the royal court. And part of that was a kind of fancification of this sort of anomaly. I don't know. Part of me wonders, you know, if this is a person that's there. I think part of it's supposed to be that sense that he looks like a court jester, and so we're supposed to think that his standard of reason is debased for that reason. He's in the lunacy is what he stands for. But I don't know. I bet you I could be convinced that he's there to entertain people, too. I'm not sure, you know. But my guess is that, at the very least, if the point of this portrait isn't that it's a part of a sequence about the character of the rake has just company is sort of the point at the end, so that he should be standing next to somebody who's acting like a horse's ass is sort of significant. How about the guy behind him who's in the middle room? Who seems to be standing there sitting there. See him with the scepter in hand, it looks like, and a crown. I think this is another one of those, like, yeah, I think I'm the King of England sort of things.
He looks like he could be talking to himself, too.
Who's holding the scepter?
Yeah.
Could be.
Or talking to the scepter, or like...
I don't know. If anything, he imagines himself as dignified in surroundings that are supposed to say otherwise. Right. Next to him, on the left of him, we have two figures. One cowering behind the door, but also scribbling, it looks like, on the wall. And there's a whole series of it, almost looks like constellational sort of illustrations. This seems to be a kind of like mad genius, almost, I think. Sort of institutionalized here, or delusion. Significantly below him is a figure looking through telescope, rolled up paper. We're not sure, but the intention being that this is someone who believes he's or see, looking at the stars, never mind the fact that he's inside in the madhouse at this particular moment, so he's probably just looking at the ceiling. These two seem to be close cousins to me, the man writing on the wall and the man with the sort of telescope below him. It almost seems like he's looking, is he looking through the wrong end? Who's truer, you know? And then we have in the other room to the left another figure in genuflection almost. Light streaming in on the, looks like a crucifix. Mm-hmm. I mean, this seems to be some kind of religious mania, I think, some kind of delusion. Certainly that we can see something touched on in some of the madhouse memoirs we read today, that figures of exaggerated religious intention can be institutionalized quite often for the delusions of being possessed or haunted. Yeah, one could also think there's papist leanings as well in this person who's been sequestered to the left-hand side. Now, given all of these various, the population of all these various persons, we have the rake in the middle, scratching his head here, the bald guy. Then he's basically being locked up. Shackles on the ankles. The woman at his side crying, attendant of some sort. And I'm guessing a madhouse employee of some kind, standing over with the wig, just making sure that either she gets pulled away from him or that the guy who's attacking the shackles is doing his job correctly. If a function of the four stages of cruelty was essentially to take us ultimately to the Royal College of Surgeons into the autopsy room to show that the just reward, the most exaggerated just reward, was to find yourself in the heart of the medical sphere in the anatomical ward, one of the most privileged spaces in the anatomical ward, the reward of cruelty here, of moral impropriety and debased moral character, is to find yourself in the heart of the institutional, psychological, medical realm and world of this particular time, too. I love these two particular series, not just because they have a similar sense of justice and punishment, but because they deploy and actually use as a terminus medicine and medical locations as the ultimate place to both treat, tolerate, punish, and to some degree wipe out social and cultural sort of like improprieties and ills. Yeah.
You know, I think that this drawing also, in terms of interpreting the rake, makes you think about tertiary syphilis. Because the way he's pulling on his absent hair,
yeah.
You know, tertiary syphilis, of course, is neurological and psychological.
Right.
So, I mean, and that's...
It can be. Yeah. In the same way that I told you, the Harlot's Progress is almost essentially about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, this would have been a time when the after effects of syphilitic infection that could have led to mental illness would have been seen as just result, so to speak, of that type of behavior. Let's turn to the mad people's account of madness. I want to look at these maybe for about the next 20 minutes. And I kind of just kind of want to do a short walkthrough. I don't want to talk about them too much, since basically one of the paper topics is tell me what you think these say. But let's look at a few examples and think about what this great confinement is or isn't, what that term great means, what these institutional punishments that are talked about in the Hogarth pamphlets and series actually speak to, and then what do the first-hand testimonials of individuals from this era actually say to the stakes of what this particular kind of institutionalization would mean? I had to look at four accounts, and I am apt to just take your advice and leave what you want to talk about, but I'll just give you a quick walkthrough of what they are. The first is, and I have them chronologically for you, from George Tross, from 1714. Tross's account, if you have been reading this sort of biography beforehand, is basically that he's a Presbyterian minister, and that his account is really one of feeling like you're being institutionalized, if not because you're mad, well, certainly because you might be tempted by Satan or the devil. So this question of blessing or curse that we talked about that hovers over much of the history of medicine is really exacerbated in an age of reason and in an age of religious sort of like fervor, if you will, to think about, am I being haunted? Am I being sort of like taunted, if you will, by Satan? So this is a testimonial that's less about bitching and moaning about the ills that I experienced in this, the predicament of being caught between one knowing, not knowing whether one is sane or insane, blessed or damned. So this is George Tross, the 21st minister. The second is from 1739 by Alexander Cruden. As I said, the London citizen exceedingly injured. The significance here are talking about, this is really a testimonial of outrage, if you will. How dare they institutionalize me? And let me just list for you all the shitty things that happened to me while I was in institution. So it's both criticizing the grounds with which one is institutionalized, great confinement, and the treatment that one experiences while they're there. This piece then becomes a kind of rebuttal to why I should not have been condemned, and also a kind of expose of what, if you like, behind the walls of a madhouse. So even if you've toured one, and you've gone to the public forum in the madhouse to see and watch the people like in the Hogarth image, you don't know what's really happening in the rooms and the wards of that place, and I'm going to tell you. That's the London citizen exceedingly injured. Say that fast 10 times. 1816 is a memoir from the early life of William Cooper. Cooper is a famous poet, English poet. If you remember from our first day of class, one of the short pieces of literature I handed out to everybody was a poem by William Cooper called Lines Composed Upon Being Put into an asylum or something that's like that. I can't remember. Put into a madhouse, I think that's what it's called. Cooper basically is a very religious man who writes from the perspective of providing a kind of Puritan memoir, if you will. And his periods in an institution were absolutely warranted. This was a man who absolutely went through severe bouts of depression, suicidal sometimes even. But they're almost always coupled with crises of faith. So Cooper's memoir here is very much like that poem that I gave at the beginning of the semester, which is about what is it to think about a really sincere psychological sort of impairment, but coupled with a feeling of sort of being adrift spiritually at the same time. And for Cooper then, this is a moment of being institutionalized and thinking about how I need to be healed of mind and saved of soul, and how they might actually be the same thing. And that's a specific perspective. So if we had a minister in the first account talking about his feelings of crisis, about being damned or sane or insane, if we have the second account of Cruden talking about being injured and outraged to being institutionalized, we have Cooper here talking about, and in fact, if you read his narrative by the end of it, it basically is like, they were really good to me when I was there. And so in other words, I'm trying to give you a difference of perspective of satisfied and dissatisfied customer, if you will. And our last is Urbain Metcalf's The Interior of Bethlehem Hospital, which is basically an account, interestingly, of what the standards are like in that place. And this is very much like an expose. In fact, it was very popular when it was printed, to that degree providing to the general public people who couldn't go and afford to go either for the transportation to get there or for entry fee to Bethlehem Hospital, they could read this account. And it certainly recounts a lot of ills, although if you've read it closely, you'll notice that its basic sentiment is basically, well, nothing really bad happened to me while I was there, but I can tell you some real horror stories if you want to know the truth. So to that degree, between some of these accounts of being absolutely outraged or absolutely distraught but happy with the services they got, there's this one that Foucault sort of straddled a little bit in between. So to that degree, thinking of Foucault's notion of a great confinement, we can actually see in just these four testimonials that there's a range of perspectives of how awful that confinement was in severe, or how awful that confinement was in the treatment you got, or how awful that confinement was in terms of how you were deemed insane or not, or how complicit you were in being deemed worthy of being in an institution. But there's also accounts that say the opposite. I wasn't there that long. I was actually in good company. I actually agreed that I should have been there. So that disparity, I think, actually speaks to the way in which Foucault is right sometimes, but not always right in terms of the memoirs that speak to it. What I wanted to do then was, for the next maybe 15 minutes or so, was have us look at a couple of moments. Did anybody have any one of these four memoirs that really they wanted to speak to more than any other right now? Particularly if you're thinking about doing a paper on this topic, this is a good time to chime in. If not, I can pick one.
Can you talk a little bit just about this tie between religion and the infiltration of thoughts about God and Satan and all of that, and that contributing in many of these pieces?
Let's start with the first one to do that. Yeah, this is the Life of Reverend Tross. Let's look on page 31. Let's look at just a couple of phrases. In fact, I'll take you to three moments in here that really speak to me. One of the things I want you to take notice of, and this is on the page 30, which is the left-hand page here. This is an edition I have, so there's lots of circles and underlines, but this will help you. On the left, you'll notice, as you'll notice in a lot of this testimony, there's a lot of the use of the word voice. Voice, 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 voice. One of the hard parts of this particular time that speaks to this religious linchpin, if you will, is that if there is a large precedent, as there is in Puritan and a lot of Anglican sort of culture at this time, to suggest that one is worthy of their spiritual fortitude when they're appropriately in touch with the voice of God. What does that mean when they think they also might be hearing voices that could speak to delusion? So there becomes a way in which there's a kind of religious culture that seems to valorize a kind of sensitivity or attuneness to a voice within that might also speak to one that is vilified within a psychological sort of discourse at this time. Now, those voices can be literal. Someone can think they're hearing Jesus talking to them, and someone can think that my Diet Coke is talking to me right now. Those could be literal. But that also means, what does it mean in the metaphorical sense when you think, listen to your inner voice? When you, though, even thinking about that concept of inner voice is so loaded with the very questions of being spiritually salvageable or psychologically debased, then you're really stuck in a difficult position. I love this account by Reverend Tross because of the fact that it speaks to what really is that dilemma between the religious and the psychological discourse of the time, which is the dilemma of rock, hard place, being caught between the two. And it almost makes it literal in this particular account. So the question of voice and how much it comes up here is one thing. Look on page 31. I want to read a couple sentences here. This one speaks to that question of culpability. How responsible am I for where I'm at in an institution and for whether or not I am damned or whether or not I'm insane. This is on page 31, in the middle where there's some underlining. It says, this breath I then believed to have been the Holy Ghost, because I had read that Christ breathed upon the disciples when he gave them the Holy Ghost. And believing that I had been inspired and taught by him in all these ridiculous acts of humiliation, I am sure they were so, as done by me, I presently concluded that I really had been guilty of the sin against the Holy Ghost, and so could not possibly be pardoned. Thus, by my careless and profane reading and hearing the word of God, and not endeavoring to understand the meaning of it, I gave the great deceiver an advantage to make me believe that the word perverted and understood in a wrong sense was the word of God. For not receiving the truth in the notion, much less in the love of it, I was disposed to believe every falsehood that the father of lies might impose upon me. Now, this is significant because there's a whole variable here of faith and belief that's significant to religion and has been for centuries. But in an age of reason, where your logic is supposed to be the thing that absolutely is you're endowed with, but if it seems to be at loggerheads or in competition with your faith, that provides a really difficult spot. So for example, if one has faith, not in an age of reason, but just has faith and begins to have doubt, well then the thought is, I need to just bolster my faith and push away the doubts that I have. I need to believe more in God. But if one has faith in an age of reason and has doubt about God, his existence, the meaning of something that's been told them, that doubt feels like it's been fueled by logic or reason. To that end, what you're doing is enacting a principle of reason that is of your age, but it seems to be in competition with the faith that for you that is supposed to be enduring, timeless, and immortal, really, for you. To that end, your reason seems to be in competition with your soul, if you will. So what Tross is talking about here, and he is a minister, no less, he's finding himself in an age of reason, in an age of institutionalization, where his faith is being not just challenged, but in some ways also seems to be conquered by some of the logic and he calls doubt that he has at this particular time. What he has just shown to do is to either metaphorize or personify it a bit further by saying, when I felt like God was touching me and breathing on me, that's what I thought it literally was. When I felt like I was not believing the word of God, I felt as though the great deceiver had infiltrated my own beliefs and ideas at that time. So the culpability is one thing to put off to the side here that's involved in one's own insanity. If one is insane, one feels in this age culpable at the stakes of religion because I didn't have faith enough, if you will, to some degree, or at least to curtail the reason that is of the era that I'm living in. The second thing I want you to look at is on page 34. If we are living at a period with which feeling God, having faith in God, and for some time, seeing God is really a sign of your belief system, what does that mean in an age of reason when to see or feel those kinds of things might simply be called delusion? So to that degree, we're living in not just an age of reason, but we're living in one of the first ages of delusion, if you will, to some degree. And religious faith and religious vision, not just voice, then, where does that get categorized? Seems to be a struggle. The bottom of page 34, Tross writes, hereupon, my friends determined to remove me to his house, but I was resolved not to move out of my bed, for I was persuaded that if I removed out of it, I should fall into hell and be plunged into the depth of misery. I likewise apprehended those about me who would have plucked me out of my bed to have been so many devils who would have dislodged me. Therefore, I stoutly resisted them with all my might and utmost efforts, and struggled with all violence, that they might not pluck me out of my bed and clothe me. When one of the persons about me came behind me to hold me up in my bed, I was under terrible apprehensions. It was the devil that seized me. And the same thought I had of all about me, that they were murderous devils, that they exerted all their power to carry me away into a place of torment. Now, this is a case where we can certainly, with hindsight, look at it and think this person's having legitimate psychological or scientific delusions in this particular moment. But we can tell that from his religious perspective and vantage point, what it felt like was a literal manifestation of being, in some ways, pulled, wrenched from his own salvation. To that end, the madhouse is a difficult place because it seems as though it's either you being thrown into the hellish pit, that's what he thinks it is, both figuratively and literally, or is it the place that's supposed to rescue you in some degree from these delusions that are informing the lack of faith you might have? Yeah?
They call the asylum a snake pit.
Yeah.
Where does that come from? Snakes.
Well, do you mean it in the 20th century sense? Because there's a kind of euphemistic longstanding referring to lots of places that are reputed as a snake pit. In the 20th century, really isolated with the famous novel, The Snake Pit, which comes from about the late 40s, and then the film that was made starring Olivia de Havilland, which came out in the 50s. I forget who directed it, but it's a pretty good film. It's basically about a woman who gets institutionalized and sort of what she has to deal with it. But I think in our common parlance, we refer to a mental institution as a snake pit. It's that book and that movie that we're thinking of in particular. So, yeah.
But these descriptions that you got here, how are these different from the Sermons of the Mathers or Jonathan Edwards? I mean, it sounds pretty similar.
Yeah, I think one of the big differences is the fact that it's absolutely and literally and biographically couched in the insane asylum in a way that it couldn't have been 50 or 100 years earlier because it just didn't exist in that particular form, and in a way that they're so consistently done here in a way that they might have only been sort of alluded to. But you're absolutely right. I think it's significant, too, that it's not like these set visions sound drastically different than sermons of other persuasions. It's the fact that they've almost been implanted on top of testimonials about
the Madhouse. I mean, they're all Presbyterians, but just, I guess, the Mathers were in Presbyterian society where he was not.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, too, that as much as you see a similarity between this sermon and other sermons that don't deal with Madhouses, there's as many similarities between this sermon and the three that follow that aren't even sermons. So therefore, it's almost a kind of like thread that runs across sermon discourse and Madhouse discourse. And in this particular one, they find almost the testimony that does both at the same time.
Yeah, he also mentions the Quakers who were very much interested in ecstatic experiences. So
yeah,
having these types of, you know, overwhelming spiritual experiences,
yeah,
and visions and,
yeah,
you know, falling on the floor and,
yeah,
what we would consider almost epileptic fits today was something that was akin to that entire religious culture.
And it's a perfect manifestation also of it does that quaking and the shakers and shaking become the evidence of one's own faith, where it begins to become the symptom of one's own illness, so to speak. And this is just a minister himself sort of making literal that particular kind of hypothesizing, if you will. I want to take you to the very end of George Strauss's, because this is my favorite part, page 37, the penultimate paragraph. I mentioned that the best part about this testimonial is that it provides in the most isolated way what is the feature of so many religious slash insane testimonials of this time. And it's that notion of rock, hard place. And this is how it's described here. Page 37 going into 38, the second to last paragraph. When I expected every moment to be cut off and cast into hell and could not but own it would be just, I would not so much as bow a knee or open my lips, either for the deferring or the diminishing of my torments there, much less for their perfect prevention. I did not shed a tear, nor bewail myself, but like a hardened sot and stupid wretch, expected an excision, and a being thrown into hell without the least endeavor to escape it. If I did put on my clothes and tied them about me, then I thought I bound myself to the devil. If I unloosed and put them off, then I fancied I unloosed myself from God. That last paragraph, that sentence, that last sentence I read for you was sort of the best part about this whole testimony for me, because what it really shows is that in this moment, it's a man actively, and by actively, I mean not just in mind, but in action, trying to will himself out of a state of delusion or of insanity. And in this case, it's being complicated by that crisis of faith that he's having. So he says, if I put my clothes on, try to seem rational and seem about me, I thought at that time that I was tying myself to God, if you will. And if I unloose them and take them off, I thought I was unloosing myself from God. So to that end, the same sort of set of actions can actually make the person feel damned. This is the literal example of damned if you do and damned if you don't, is what this man is basically describing in this particular moment. And that really is sort of one of the complicating things in this particular moment, not for him as a minister, but I think for him in an institution, in an age of reason, and in particular having a crisis of faith at this moment. And I want to talk about Nina Others, if you're, we can probably do one more. I will state this again, that in thinking about the London citizen exceedingly injured, I beg you to take a few minutes, especially if you want to write about it, to think about what it is that this is titled by the London Citizen, and that Defoe's Journal of the Plague Year was also titled by a London Citizen, and that each is trying to provide a kind of testimonial expose of what it was like to be in this particular place at this particular moment for the enticement of the readers, if you will, and also to provide an endowed sense of gravitas and also authority in the author, the protagonist, the speaker themselves. So that in the case of the Journal of the Plague Year, the London Citizen is really somebody who's speaking not just as an outsider eyewitness, but an insider talking about what was different about that place in that particular moment. And so the voice that we get, because it's identified as a citizen, is therefore the voice of somebody who knows exactly what London is normally like, and therefore all the better can tell us how different it is in a time of plague. In the case of this narrative, he's described as a London citizen. And why do you think that is? What does that change? If you took out and just said, the person exceedingly injured, how is it different here to call him a London citizen? I think the biggest, yeah.
But this is just a man who lives in the intellectual center of the world.
Yeah. Which is to say that in the same way that the London Citizen in the Journal of the Plague Year gets to be an emblematic figure for writing about this atrocity happening to a city with all of the character and endowments of that city, so too does this man. It also speaks to what is the overriding sentiment of what this particular testimonial is. And it's one word. Outrage. I mean, this is the testimonial of outrage. And to have it coming from the London Citizen is to suggest even greater the stakes of that outrage. This was not enacted just on anybody. It was enacted on a London citizen. And therefore, reading it provides not just titillating details for us as readers, but if we're London citizens ourselves reading it, a bit of paranoia on our part, too. The fear that you, too, could be institutionalized before you know it. And speaking to that quote that Irwin had us think about earlier, too, in the sense that the notion of the very concept of a citizen can itself be jettisoned as needed in order to institutionalize somebody. So to that degree, the degree of outrage and the degree of injury is sort of exacerbated by the degree of this person being a London citizen. What I'm going to do actually is just direct you towards a few passages. So in case you are thinking of writing on this topic or just want to look at a few more passages in here, I might direct you just from the ones that I think are enjoyable and fun. One thing I want you to take note of also, too, and this is from the London Citizen by Alexander Cruden. It mentions on page 47 a bit about his biography. One of the important things to note about Cruden was that it says he's a London publisher, proofreader, author, and eccentric, is how that is described here. But the fact that professionally he is a publisher, proofreader, and author, if you're thinking about doing this topic on whether these accounts signify that there is a disaster, consider what the professions of these individuals are. For example, the first one that we read on George Tross, right? Tross, thank you, George Tross. How is it a disaster for this man? Well, one cannot divorce the fact that he is a minister writing a sermon about being institutionalized based on religious mania without thinking how significant being a minister cuts even more at that sense of debasement. In the same way that Cruden's story of injury, I think can't help but be informed by that, but this is a guy who's a publisher and proofreader and author. I mean, he is a part of the literati sort of culture of London, and yet here he is being put in an institution in an age of reason, basically saying that this is a man who has no mastery of language or of logic, and yet that's what he prides himself professionally on being. Therefore, all the more reason that when he gets out, he should take pen in hand and be like, I'll show you, I'm going to write about this shit, you know, and write about it in detail. To that end, I'd have you look at page 53 through about the end, 56. What I want you to pay attention to, if you want to think about this, is that this is called The London Citizen Exceedingly Injured. But if you'll notice, there's a shift in just this excerpt that we get from this text where he's referred to as the prisoner in the third person. So that he's referring to himself in the third person is one thing. Although that's not too weird because the title is in the third person, The London Citizen Exceedingly Injured, right? It's not I was exceedingly injured. But that the narrative is third person, but there's a shift from a London citizen to a prisoner. So the way that he has been sequestered into being in an asylum has also changed the very nomenclature with which he gets to be described. So that what's happened is it's not just a jettisoning of the individual from London to the asylum, but from the category of the citizen to one being called the prisoner. So the dilemma here, the disaster to me, isn't just spatial, what institution you're in or not. It's not just in terms of treatment, it's also categorical. What you're called seems to be part of the injury, if you will, to some degree. I had you take a look at how systematic this guy is. It's like a journal of diary entries here. You know, dates, weights, foods. He's talking about people by name. He even gets to talking about, like, on the next page, Wednesday, May 31st, the prisoner's birthday. He awoke early, performed his devotions, held his chain in his hand, full fastened to his leg, and deliberately got out of the window to the garden, mounted the garden wall with much difficulty, lost one of his slippers, and jumped down to the back way just before the clock struck two. This strikes me as the insane asylum's testimonial equivalent of this. Right? I mean, he's doing all the motions to show us, I am sane, I am sane, I am sane, if you will, to some degree. And how systematic he is and how thorough he is, I think, is supposed to provide for us an entree into sanity. What's significant, then, is that the first text talks about sort of moral disquietude, being caught between a rock and a hard place. This one talks a lot about outrage. It also seems to me to be very evidentiary. Part of the function of this document is to provide evidence to show you that I am sane to some degree. So I look at the details in terms of stylistically how this one works. For number three, which is by William Cooper, I would pay attention to the way in which it's not from a minister, but it's absolutely religious in form. But there's a way in which what he's trying to find at the institution is a kind of healing. Healing of mind, but also of spirit at the same time. The periods that I like the most to talk about here are pages 69 and the last page, 73. 73 in particular, which is the ending, because he describes, for example, in the third last paragraph, my physician, ever watchful and apprehensive for my welfare, was now alarmed lest the sudden transition from despair to joy should terminate in the fatal frenzy. And he continues to describe that sense of almost gratitude for that kind of treatment. I think it's Cooper, by the way, let me check and see, who was institutionalized for quite a time also in a private madhouse as opposed to just a public one. So we might want to think also about the way in which this testimonial comes not from just a different vantage point, but also from a very different kind of institution as well. And the last one is called The Interior of Bethlehem Hospital. This one, if you haven't got a chance to read it or if you want to reread it, it'd be kind of fun to read it as I have in the past with Hogarth's Last Plate next to you. Because this Hogarth is based on Bethlehem Hospital. It might be sort of fun to see if this is what the common image of what Bethlehem Hospital was to people in the 18th century, just at a satirical sort of exaggerated level. That's what this sort of narrative is trying to speak and sort of a bit of reaction to also. One of the other nitty-gritty things that speak to it. And so this piece is definitely of the more expose sort of variety. Testimonials I would have you look at in here would be page 83, page 84 and 85, and then the last two pages. In particular, the way in which, if you notice on page 83, the parts I have underlined, he mentions how someone was made a slave and was tied up, and how someone was treated poorly. And then he has a sentence that reads the second part I have underlined, "I myself have not cause to complain, as I was greatly treated with great civility. But I am, from a sense of humanity, pleading the cause of the unfortunate," etc., etc. Outrage is a spirit that inspires this testimonial as well, but for a different sort of purpose. There almost seems to be a kind of social justice imperative rather than a personal justice, if you will, to some degree. Looking at the very end, and this is the part I want to end on, one of the interesting things about Urbane Metcalf's piece is that his turn at the end, if it seems to be almost philanthropic in the way that he wants to provide an expose at Bethlehem Hospital, not because his treatment was bad, but because he had to witness bad treatment. Maybe he needs to exorcise it, get it out of himself, purge it from himself in some way. He does it in the spirit of also saying that we need to be mindful of the treatment of the insane and at Bethlehem Hospital because of the fact that it also bears witness to us as a nation and a character. The last two pages, he talks about in England, in this great country so famed for its munificence, thinking about the qualities and the attributes that define the core of a culture and a community and a value, whether the treatment of the insane lives up to that standard. Or as he writes at the very end of this testimonial, "Our country has been famed throughout the world for the splendor of her charitable institutions. Remedy their abuses, her fame will be just." In other words, that's the command. Remedy the injustice in these institutions. "At present, however laudable the intentions of its supporters may be, the unfortunate who are compelled to claim their protection finds virtuous establishments prostituted to vicious purposes by wretches whose least crime is a total abuse of humanity." Which is to say that if Foucault says there is a great confinement and it's based on the principles, the foundations, and the methodologies for how reason and how the asylum were created, we have at the other end of the extreme someone like Urbane Metcalf here at the end who finds fault with these asylums, but his fault seems to be that there is corruption in how they're used, not the purposes that they exist at all. All four of these testimonials, I think, provide a little bit of that perspective from one end of the great confinement to the other. But hopefully what you'll find in them, if you choose to the paper or if you just want to think some more about this topic after class, is that the confinement that happened was unique and novel at that time, but perhaps not great. At least not great in number and not great in geographic reach, but great perhaps in the way that it affected individual lives in profound and significant ways. Thanks so much, everybody. Have a good week. Thank you.